August the 18th, 1981. Truth for Today Bible Class. And we begin our program tonight by a study from Isaiah, the 4th chapter. Isaiah, the 4th chapter. We covered the 3rd chapter last week and started on the 4th chapter. And we will start there again now. Now, last week in the 3rd chapter, we had talked there in the next to the last verse that thy men shall fall by the sword, and thy mighty men in the war. Now, this is a war coming up. And, of course, the direct prophecy that we have here is no doubt referring to the Babylonian captivity. But there are overtones. And sometimes what is spoken of directly may have some descriptions come along with it of a future time. A time when they will have their captivity under the Antichrist. Now, and in that day, that is when men shall fall by the sword, and mighty men in the war, then in that day, 7 women shall take hold of 1 man, saying, we will eat our own bread, and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by their name to take away our reproach. In other words, there'll be so many men killed in this war that they be left seven women for 1 man. And so the women will become so emboldened in those days because it was a reproach for them to be unmarried. They'll become so bold that they will approach the man and ask him to marry. And not only that, but they will forego all of the rights and privileges of a wife as given in Deuteronomy. The man should support his wife and give her her apparel and so forth and so forth. But here they say that we will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. They'll keep themselves. So that is the straits to which things will come in a future day and about what they happened back in a day before at the Babylonian captivity. So only let us be called by thy name. In other words, they just wanted the name of a husband so that their reproach would be taken away. And verse 2. In that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious. Now, when we studied the signs of the zodiac, the very first sign is Virgo, the Virgin. And in her hand she has the branch representing the Messiah. In fact, one of the versions, one of the ancient versions, translates that Messiah rather than branch. And in that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful. Now this is taking away ahead too, you see. Now, there might have been a partial fulfillment of this and so on in the restoration to Jerusalem, but not like it's going to be when the Lord appears from heaven and sets up his millennial kingdom. And the fruit of the earth shall be excellent. Now, in this case, the fruit of the earth is the Messiah again. He is the glorious one. He should be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. Now, there are two fulfillments there. There were those who escaped the sword at the time of the Babylonian captivity. And then there are those who will escape the tribulation in the future day, or at least not escape it in the way of missing it or anything like that, but they will experience a deliverance. And that's a little bit different because they may be killed and still resurrected and delivered. And the verse 3, and it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem, that's all the same thing, Jerusalem and Zion. This is a little poetic repetition. Shall be called holy. There'll be a remnant that'll be called holy. And this is even every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem. Now there was a habit back in the days of Israel to have the names of all of Israel written. This was done a number of times, and the houses of Israel kept separate and so on. It was a place where they could go to get their pedigree, their heritage from their family, and it was a way of proving their identity and the rights to their property. It was given to them by lot. Now that was very, very carefully kept by Israel and kept in the archives of the temple. Now when Titus destroyed the temple in AD 70, all those records are burned up. And that is why that today there is no man that can prove that he's a Jew. He has no record. And these folks had a record. Writing. Now that will be fulfilled again, because before Israel can take her place, build her temple, have the Aaronic priesthood and so on, Elijah has to come restore all these things. And he'll be able to tell the people to what tribe and family they belong. Now that'll be a miraculous thing too, but it'll be necessary. Just as necessary as it was here. Now we do find there were one or two times at least, and David once numbered Israel. But that numbering and taking a list was not for the purpose of their inheritance and genealogy and so on, but for making up an army, conscription. And that was what was wrong, and why that there was a plague started, because of this disobedience. But it was all right to keep a list of those. You can remember when you go back into the time of the judges and read the story of Ruth. And there was the inheritance that she came into because of her marriage with a Jewish boy by the name of Malan. And so the inheritance was restored. Now that was witnessed to and known by the people. And she had this inheritance in case it were redeemed. Of course, now that all had to come in the story too. And we won't go into the details of that. That's a very interesting study. And so there is a time when there will be those who in Jerusalem and written in the book of the life, we might say, is it will happen. They will be called holy and so on. Now, verse 4, this connects with this other, among the living in Jerusalem, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion. Now, the daughters of Zion are the people of Israel. So if you would just keep that in mind, it's a figure of speech, but it's the people of Israel. And shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment. Now there you have purge, which means to cleanse. And you have the blood there of for their blood guiltiness, as it says in your note. In other words, their murders and so on. And so that'll all be cast out, purged, cleansed. This isn't purgatory. Nothing like that. So there will be a spirit of judgment, and by the spirit of burning. Now, sometime you may want to take a little study of the word judgment and judge. It has, rather, a variety of meanings. I was talking to somebody in the last couple of days in which the little subject came up, and I reminded him that to judge could mean to settle disputes, to find somebody guilty and give him a sentence. But when the 12 apostles were promised that they would sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel, it didn't necessarily mean that. It meant that they were to oversee them in their evangelistic efforts among the nations of the world. And then, we have used something like that a number of times. There were the judges in the book of Judges that came and delivered Israel from their oppressors. And they were leaders in that instance of Israel. I'm just trying to think of another meaning that slips my mind right now that I wanted to use on that. But we are to judge whether things are good or evil. That's making the difference between them. Now we have a judgment seat of Christ, the Bema, and that is where people receive their rewards. Only believers will appear before that. No unbeliever ever appear for any rewards for work done. And so you go on and on with that word judgment. I wouldn't be able to exhaust them now without having some notes on it. But here there would be a spirit of judgment and a spirit of burning. Now the burning has to do with cleansing and also for melting and getting out the dross, like purifying gold. Now these different meanings can be used in that. Well, for us Gentiles to think of these things and imagine them, of course, is a little difficult because we don't have the background, the bringing up of Israelites, and we would hardly understand, possibly, their great love for Jerusalem, that down through the centuries it came to mean a lot to Israel, and there are a lot of people today who still think a great deal of Jerusalem, that call themselves Jews. In fact, it's been amazing that what has happened over in that land. Ordinarily, in this country of ours, you don't find a Jew owning a piece of ground for farming. They might own real estate for rental purposes. I've seen that done. That's good investment, and they're good investors. But I never have known, in all of my going around, a Jewish farmer. Don't remember of one. And yet there are bankers and clerks and businessmen of all kinds and so on going over to that holy land who never had dug in the dirt before and get their piece of ground and lift heavy stones and carry them off of it and till the ground and so on and become farmers right off. Love has been instilled in them through centuries of that land that God promised Abraham. It's rather touching when you see some of their devotion to this, which was a promise, even though they may be today in a great measure in unbelief. It's hard to describe it. It's hard for us to judge just what is in their minds and what their real intents are. Now, verse 5, "And the Lord shall create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion, and upon her assemblies, a cloud and smoke by day, and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defense." This reminds us of the leaving of Egypt and going into the wilderness, where by day they had a pillar of cloud to follow if they were moving from one camp to the other, which they did a great deal of. And at night it was a pillar of fire, and it lighted the way. Now, it seems rather strange that people might be moving by night, but in that particular climate and so on, that's far preferable to moving in the daytime. Because the daytime there, the heat of the sun comes on, especially during the middle of the day, it gets pretty hot. And it's not a custom, or wasn't a custom back in those times, to travel unless it was something very urgent. Now there, he says he will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion. That is not only for the whole group, but there for each dwelling place, each home. "And upon her assemblies," her synagogues, "a cloud and a smoke by day and a shining of a flaming fire by night." Now you see some of this same light shown in the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle in the wilderness, and also in Solomon's temple. And it designated or made known that God's presence was there. That was the way God had of expressing himself and assuring his people that he was among them, with them. Otherwise, they might have thought that he was afar off and his temple was empty. And to all intents and purposes, it was empty. A heathen would have, and they did, make fun of it. They go in, if they went into the holy place, they couldn't go into the Holy of Holies, went into the holy place, where they went for worship and the priests performed their duties and so on, they would see no image or idol. And early Christians were called atheists by the Romans because they didn't have any visible gods to worship. And so there was a purpose here. Israel were to keep away from the idolatrous practices of the heathen. And so here will be a time when each family or home or house and each assembly will have these marks of the presence of God. That's a day to come. Now, that hasn't been fulfilled yet that I know of. Now, the glory was in the temple, but Ezekiel saw it depart, and it's never gone back since. "And upon all the glory shall be a defense." Well, there might be something here to look at. This word defense is a word which it means a canopy. And your note says chuppa, the marriage canopy. And so on. And yet, we have some folks who don't believe that that is exactly what it is, but that it may be something else. However, in the next verse, we have again something similar. possibly this here does mean, verse 5, does mean a marriage canopy, defense being the word canopy, the chupa. And it's never translated defense anywhere else, you're told. But we'll go on to the next verse here. And there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and for a covert from storm and rain. Now, tabernacle here is called pavilion. Now, how much this is connected with the practice of travelers in that time, I would not be able to say. I have seen some various opinions on it. But it was a practice in those days for a person to, in traveling, to have along with him some means of defense or cover from storm and rain. And it was usually something that we put up like a small tent or a little miniature tabernacle. Now, whether it was something like the modern army pup tents, I don't know. Probably was. But maybe here this means that there'd be something larger than that. A pavilion, as it says here. At any rate, he'll be a protection for his people. That is what the, what this is for, is a comfort to Israel. Now that ends your chapter 5. Or 4, excuse me. And we're ready for chapter 5. Now, like chapter 4 and really chapter 3, although chapter 3 and 4 are connected by that falling of a great many men and then the seven women taking hold of one man, there's that much connection, but otherwise they don't seem to be too much connected. And chapter 5 doesn't seem to be connected with either of these two. It takes up another theme, and that is one thing that has thrown the commentators a great deal about Isaiah. They have figured that it's written by various writers and then compiled. But I think, what was it we read when we started over in chapter 1? Well, it says the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos. And when you start with chapter 2, I think you have about the same thing. It's the word that Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. It's a series of visions, a series of prophecies put out by this man Isaiah, the son of Amos. And as I said in the introduction, our first night we were on this, that it covered a number of years. And you'll find that in the margin of your companion Bible. About what years it did cover. And it says about 649 to 588 B.C. Now, we may run into something pretty after a while, which will make some connection with that, too. All right, now beginning with chapter 5. Now will I sing to my beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. Well, we just leave that as it is. There are some difference of opinion there. More to see who the beloved is. Now, the word beloved is practically in the Hebrew is the same as the word David. But David is not in view here. It's the one of whom David was a type, the Messiah of Israel. Now will I sing to my, well, you can't say Jehovah, you could say my Messiah, but Jehovah does mean my Lord. I will sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. Now, we're going to get a little parable here, and I think you can sense that when we start. It's rather a common thing. We have parables in our Bible, in our New Testament, have one very similar to this, about a vineyard. And he fenced it. Now, you put a fence around to keep out undesirable things. He fenced it and gathered out the stones thereof. And that was always necessary over in that land. His stones everywhere. Well, I've been through that too. I have picked lots and lots of stone off the fields, and it seems that you pick them off and get them all clean, and the stones are all gone. In just a few years, they're just as thick as ever again. And you have to pick them all over again. And if you happen to come out to our farm and look down behind the barn where there's a washout over next to the line fence, you'll see a lot of stones thrown in a washout there to stop the water from washing it out. And it did it, too. There's many a trailer load of stones thrown in there. Now, that's just a little realistic there because Israel had to gather the stone off of their land in order to farm it. Now, my dad used to farm a hillside in West Virginia. One time a mother was visiting there, she wondered why all those stones, especially gathered in piles, it seemed, in little gullies on the hillside. And Dad, with his dry sense of humor, he didn't talk too much. He said, well, the devil's apron string broke, and he's gathering up stones, and they all fell in a heap like that. Mother didn't buy that, of course. I just wanted to emphasize that because everyone is farming over in Palestine today has had to or will have to, or is clearing his land of stones. They are very, very plentiful. Now, those stones were good for something. And don't let's just say that they were entirely a nuisance. There are some people who are beginning to realize that stones can be very helpful in a garden. You put stones, something like a mulch, alongside a row of something you want to grow real nicely, and they will hold moisture under them, like a mulch. And also, during the day, they will still be a little cool from the heat of the night before, the cold of the night before. And so your plants won't get too awfully hot, and yet they'll gather enough heat that'll keep them nice and warm during the night. That's sort of an insulation business. And so some have found that in growing some garden plants especially, that stone mulch is just a thing. I'm spending a little time on that simply because I want you to realize, and if you've seen a lot of pictures of holy land, you'll notice that in many of these, especially old pictures, there's just stones everywhere. Now, I can go on and say something more about the rock that they have over there and the rock that they have and the hillsides and so on. That rock is filled full of the nutrients that plants need. And those rocks are not very hard. And it is said that a man can take a crowbar and jam a hole in one of those rocks and plant in a young olive tree and tamp it down, and that it will take hold and root and burst the rock open and get its food out of the rock. In other words, that land over there has everything that's necessary except in water. And when they get the water on it, they can raise wonderful crops. Beats any place else seemingly in the world. Their fruit and so on is just exported out to other countries. It's just better than we can produce in our own United States of America. Whether it be, you've got three places on for oranges and so on. We don't dare to take sides either. But they have Florida oranges, and they have Texas oranges, and they have California oranges. But it seems that Israel's oranges are the best of all. Well, I just digressed a little bit there because I wanted you to get a picture. If you haven't seen a lot of pictures of Palestine and so on, why? And that was one thing that was said of the people in Psalm 91, of the young people who were to enter into the land and who hadn't tempted the Lord like their parents had, and they said that the angels would hold them up lest they should dash their foot against a stone. Did you ever stub your toe on a stone? No, that's it. Well, he had a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. Now, there again is referring to Mount Zion, or all of the country around about it. So we're getting a little parable here, and some prophecy. And he fenced it, gathered out the stones thereof, and planted it with the choicest vine, and built a tower in the midst of it. Well, now the choicest vine. Do you remember about the grapes of Eshcol? Now this is speaking about something like that, the grapes of Eshcol. It's hard to believe. In a country like I live in here, where grapes grow small, but like currants sometimes, that a bunch of grapes would have to be put on a pole and carried on the shoulders of two men. But that's exactly what happened in the Exodus and so on. When they're in the wilderness and they sent the spies into the land, they brought back the grapes of Eshcol. And so here's the choicest grapes, and the name is the same as those that use the grapes of Eshcol. However, it doesn't appear in the text here. Translators missed it. And he built a tower in the midst of it. Now, ordinarily, a grape plantation, and they didn't use that word, but a man who had a hill and had grapes and so on would have a shelter in the midst of it for a man to watch, to keep out the young foxes, to destroy the grapes and so on. But this is a tower. And about the nearest thing we can think of that from some of the practices even yet today is that it was something like a big barn with a lookout on top of it, and it held the tools and so on were needful for tending the grapes, the pruning shears and plow and all of the pails and so on, baskets they needed for the gathering and so forth. And that made a nice looking place with a sort of a hill and a tower on the top of it and the grapevines all around and so on. And then made a wine press, or that could have been translated a lake therein. Usually the wine press was hewn out of the rock in the ground, and sometimes in caves if they could find one at all. And then it was lined with masonry, make a very smooth surface and waterproof surface, into which they ran the wine. Now, if it was out in the open like it was sometimes, that hot sun would spoil their wine. But if they could keep it cool, like in a cave or in a depression in the earth, why, they could keep it cool enough that it wouldn't spoil. So, they had the wine vat. Now, of course, you probably know that in those days that they took off their shoes and got into the wine press and tramped the grapes to get the juice out of them, and it ran out of pipe and into the, which is called a wine press here, but is really the vat or whatever they put it in. And, of course, I guess it, a person's feet could be just about as clean as their hands, so we shouldn't think too much of that. In fact, over there, they had the habit of washing their feet daily any hour or more, because they just had sandals and their feet got dirty with all the dust and so on, they had to wash them. Well, there he got everything all set. And then he looked. He looked and he looked that it should bring forth grapes. And it brought forth wild grapes. Now, not exactly a good translation. It'd be better to say poisonous berries. It was bad. Now, in the grapes, among the grapevines over there, there was a, well, wild weed that grew. It belonged to the nightshade family, and you know right away that many members of the nightshade family are poisoned, excepting potatoes and tomatoes and eggplant and so on. And some of those caused some people to have some allergies. Well, these berries would come in there, and they were poisonous. And it was one thing for them to do was to keep grubbing those out. And they got pretty good-sized stalks on them. By the way, folks, another thing, too. We think of a grapevine here as being a sort of a slender thing. Well, you go out in Northern California, and you'll find grapevines growing almost like young trees. They don't need any wires for support and so on, like I've always been used to. But over in Palestine, they got even bigger than that, and there were grapevines that it would be difficult for a person to reach around with both arms. Now, there'd get to be some old grapevines and varying grapes. They pruned them and kept them very carefully, and they could last for a long time. And while I'm at it, I can take time here to give you a little local color on this. It was discovered here a number of years ago when Israel were going over there and reclaiming the land, trying to find all they could from the Bible about the different plants that grew there so they could grow them again. And some of them, of course, were pretty hard to identify because the translators of our Bible wasn't acquainted or weren't acquainted with these plants. But they did discover something, that on the hillsides there were terraces, that is, like big steps, if you know what a terrace is. And placed along on these were piles of stones. And these stones are fixed into a sort of a pyramid shape with the center of it empty, and the stones, which were more or less squared, taken out of strata of stones and be probably like unshaped bricks, would be made in a circle and coming up sort of to a peak with holes around the sides where they weren't put close together. And on the inside, there were traces of something that looked like it might have been a grapevine sometime. And these are pretty good-sized structures. And finally, they discovered what it was. That was their irrigation system. Now, at night, the damp winds from off the Mediterranean come up over those hills. And these rocks, cool rocks, would condense the moisture. There'd be enough every night to trickle down to this moisture, this dew, to keep those grapes watered. That was the irrigation system. Now, that was a great discovery here a few years ago, because that had all been forgotten. No, it wasn't even practiced over there anymore. Now, that's just one of the great discoveries that's been made over in Palestine. You could read a whole book on that, probably. Now, I happen to know that that could be true because we once lived in a city, we're in the suburbs of a city, and we were near a lake, a big lake, Lake Erie, and at night, the water would condense on our roof, and it was an asphalt roof, would condense on that, would be dripping off of it like we're having a light rain. So I can understand a little bit about that condensing on those rocks. There'd be quite a bit of water. Now, we don't ordinarily, around this part where I'm living now, we don't have that heavy a dew, although sometimes it gets pretty wet, and it takes sometimes half a day. And here lately, when they had some wet weather, the grass never got dry enough all day that you could really mow it decently. Now, I bring that out because, again, one of the great problems of that land is water. And yet there's a prophecy that someday, when Israel will come to her senses, and will receive her Messiah, and he comes, that land is going to have water and blossom like the rose. And not only that, but the Arabian Desert and all that desert east of Palestine, clear over to Babylon. Why, that land there, if it had water, could sustain millions of people. So I'm just bringing this in to give you a little idea, because I know a number of years ago I didn't have much idea what Palestine was like. I'd seen pictures and so on too, but just hadn't got descriptions. Well, it brought forth these poisonous berries, these wild grapes. Now what to do? And so the prince says, I now go to. I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, that is the fence, and it shall be eaten up, and break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down, and I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned, nor digged, that is, cultivated, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. Isn't that about the way a lot of it is today? Now, what's the explanation? For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah, his pleasant plant. And he looked for judgment. Here this word comes up again. Equity. Treating everybody right. And what did he find? Oppression. Poisonous berries. And he looked for righteousness. And behold the cry of the oppressed. That's what he found. So he's explaining the parable. Now you have something of the same thing in Luke, where the parable was that the man was his vineyard and he put his servants in charge of it and went away, and they didn't do anything and so on and let it go to waste and so forth. And there was a day of reckoning. And woe to them. Now this sounds modern. Woe unto them that join house to house. Houses so close together like they're joined. Well, we have a lot of those today, don't we? And lay field to field. Well, they're still using fields, but I suppose this would be their yards and so on. Till there be no place. No place for what? That's the question. Or maybe no place to raise their food and so on, they should have. That they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. City living has always been a curse to mankind. There's only one city. Only one city. That could be otherwise. Now you might think I'm going to mention London or Paris or somewhere like that. No, it's the New Jerusalem. But that'll be different conditions entirely than what we have now.